In December 1803, the American flag was raised upon the government buildings of New Orleans, and the United States entered upon the possession of 900,000 square miles of new territory. The acquisition of Louisiana brought a new restlessness into American politics and a desire for further advance. West Florida, which stretched along the Gulf of Mexico, still belonged to Spain, and beyond the newly acquired lands, the plains of Texas beckoned. Troubles were stirred up between the western states and territories and the federal capital. The evil genius of these years is Aaron Burr. Burr, as we have seen, had missed a chance of becoming president in 1800, largely owing to Hamilton's intervention. Now, in 1804, Hamilton's opposition stopped him being selected for the governorship of New York. He challenged Hamilton to a duel. Hamilton accepted, intending to satisfy honor by firing wide, but Aaron Burr shot to kill, and thus put an end to the life of one of the outstanding figures in the founding years of the American Republic. Discredited in the eyes of all, Burr cast about for means of creating a new American realm of his own. He even sought a large bribe from the British government. Whether he hoped to detach the western states from the Union, or to carve off a slice of the Spanish dominions, is still obscure and disputed. But his career ended abruptly with his arrest and trial for treason. For lack of evidence, he was acquitted and went into voluntary exile. Jefferson had been triumphantly re-elected president in 1804, but his second term of office was less happy than his first. Under the stress of westward expansion, his party in the East was splitting into local factions. The renewal of European war had also revived the old sinister issues of embargo, blockade, and impressment. Jefferson was faced with the provocations of the British fleet, which continually arrested ships and took off sailors on the verge of American territorial waters, and sometimes even within them. The British were entitled, by the customs of the time, to impress British subjects who happened to be serving in American ships. But they also made a practice of impressing American citizens, and many sailors whose nationality was doubtful. To this grievance was added another. In retaliation for Napoleon's Berlin decrees, establishing a continental blockade of Britain, orders in council were issued in London in 1807, imposing severe restrictions on all neutral trade with France and her allies. United States commerce was hard hit by both these belligerent measures. But, as the Battle of Trafalgar had proved, the Royal Navy was much more powerful than the French, and it was at the hands of the British that American shipping suffered most. Amidst these troubles, Jefferson remained serenely determined to preserve the peace. But public opinion was mounting against him. On his recommendation, in 1807, Congress passed an Embargo Act, which forbade American ships to sail for foreign waters. It prohibited all exports from America by sea or land, and all imports of certain British manufactures. Jefferson hoped that the loss of American trade would oblige the belligerents to come to terms, but in fact his measure proved far more damaging to American commerce than to either the British or French. The economy of New England and all the seaports of the Atlantic coast depended on trade with Britain. From everywhere in the eastern states, protests went up, New England being particularly vociferous. The Federalists were quick to rally their forces and join in the outcry. Jefferson's own party, the Republicans, revolted and divided against him. After it had been in operation for 14 months, he was forced to withdraw the embargo. 3 days later, his term of office expired, and he retired to his Virginian estate of Monticello. The failure of his policies in the last 2 years of his presidency should not obscure the commanding position of Thomas Jefferson in the history of the United States. He was the first political idealist among American statesmen, and the real founder of the American democratic tradition. Contact with the perils of high policy during the crisis of World War modified the original simplicity of his views, but his belief in the common man never wavered. Although his dislike of industrialism weakened in later years, he retained to the end his faith in a close connection between yeoman farming and democracy. His strength lay in the frontier states of the West, which he so truly represented and served in over 30 years of political life. Chapter 9. The War of 1812. The new President of the United States in March 1809 was James Madison. As Jefferson's Secretary of State, he'd had much experience of public office, and he was a political theorist of note. There was a stubborn side to his nature, and his practical skill and judgment were not always equal to that of his predecessor. Madison inherited an inflamed public opinion and a delicate state of relations with Great Britain. At first there were high hopes of a settlement. Madison reached a provisional agreement with the British minister in Washington, which was very favourable to British interests. But the Foreign Secretary, Canning, repudiated the document and recalled the minister responsible for it. He was never so happy in his handling of America as he was in Europe. For 3 years, Anglo-American relations grew steadily worse. Madison was deceived by Napoleon's revocation of the Berlin decrees, which had closed all European ports controlled by France. He now tried to get England to reciprocate by annulling her orders in council against trade with ports in French hands. In vain, wiser politicians warned him that Napoleon's action was merely a diplomatic move to catch us into a war with England. The unofficial trade war with the United States was telling heavily upon England. The loss of the American market and the hard winter of 1811 to 1812 had brought widespread unemployment and a business crisis. Petitions were sent to Parliament begging the government to revoke the orders in council. After much hesitation, Castlereagh, now at the Foreign Office, announced in the House of Commons that the government had done so. But it was too late. The Atlantic crossing took too long for the news to reach America in time. On June the 18th, 1812, 2 days after Castlereagh's announcement, Congress declared war on Great Britain. In the following week, Napoleon began his long-planned invasion of Russia. The root of the quarrel, as American historians have pointed out, lay not in rival interpretations of maritime law, but in the problems of the western frontier. The seaboard states, and especially New England, wanted peace. Their main concern was America's foreign trade, which had already gravely diminished. War with Britain would bring it to a stop. But American domestic politics had brought to power representatives of the West and Southwest who were hostile to Britain, and it was they, not the merchants of the Atlantic coastline, who forced America into the conflict. On the frontiers, and especially in the Northwest, men were hungry for land, and this could be had only from the Indians or from the British Empire. Trouble with the Indians had been brewing for some time. The pioneers of the early 19th century were woodsmen. They had already occupied the forest lands held by redskin tribes in Illinois and Indiana. They now coveted the forests of British Canada round the Great Lakes, with their unsettled crown territory and tiny population of loyalists. As the western territories of America filled up, pressure mounted for a farther northwesterly move. In 1811, the Red Indians bordering on the Ohio united under their last great warrior leader, Tecumseh. On his orders, the tribes now showed themselves impervious to the temptations of liquor and trade. Alarm spread along the frontier. A revival of Indian power would put an end to further expansion. Troops were called out by the governor of Indiana, William Henry Harrison, who'd been largely responsible for the recent westward push. And in November 1811, the Indian Confederacy was overthrown at the Battle of Tippecanoe. It is one of the legends of American history that the resistance of the Indians was encouraged and organized from Canada, a legend created by the War Party of 1812. A new generation was entering American politics, headed by Henry Clay from Kentucky and John C. Calhoun from South Carolina. These young men formed a powerful group in the House of Representatives, which came to be known as the War Hawks. They had no conception of affairs in Europe, they cared nothing about Napoleon's designs, still less about the fate of Russia. Their prime aim and object was to seize Canada and establish American sovereignty throughout the whole northern continent. Through the influence of Clay, the president was won over to a policy of war. The causes of the conflict were stated in traditional terms: impressment, violations of the 3-mile limit, blockades, and orders in council. Opinion in America was sharply divided, and New England voted overwhelmingly against the declaration of war. But the war hawks, with their vociferous propaganda, had their way. The frontier spirit in American politics was coming in with a vengeance, and it was sure of itself. Moreover, the frontier farmers felt they had a genuine grievance. There was some good ground for the slogan of free trade and sailors' rights, which they adopted. British restrictions on American shipping were holding up the export of their produce. A short expedition of pioneers would set things right, it was thought, and dictate peace in Quebec in a few weeks. Congress adjourned without even voting extra money for the American Army or Navy. On paper, the forces were very unequal. The population of the United States was now 7.25 million, including slaves. In Canada, there were only 500,000 people, most of them French. But there were nearly 5,000 trained British troops, about 4,000 Canadian regulars, and about the same number of militia. The Indians could supply between 3,000 and 4,000 auxiliaries. The American regular army numbered less than 7,000 men, and although with great difficulty over 400,000 state militia were called out, few were used in Canada. On the American side, never more than 7,000 men took part in any engagement, and the untrained volunteers proved hopeless soldiers. Nor was this all. The 7 Years' War had shown that Canada could only be conquered by striking up the St. Lawrence, but the Americans had no sufficient navy for such a project. They were therefore forced to fight an offensive war on a wide frontier, impassable at places, and were exposed to Indian onslaughts on their columns. Their leaders had worked out no broad strategy. If they'd concentrated their troops on Lake Ontario, they might have succeeded, but instead they made half-hearted and uncoordinated thrusts across the borders. The first American expedition ended in disaster. The ablest British commander, General Isaac Brock, supported by the Indian Confederacy, drove it back. By August, the British were in Detroit, and within a few days, Fort Dearborn, where Chicago now stands, had fallen. The American frontier rested once more on a line from the Ohio to Lake Erie. The remainder of the year was spent on fruitless moves upon the Niagara front, and operations came to an inconclusive end. The British in Canada were forced to remain on the defensive while great events were taking place in Europe. The war at sea was more colourful, and for the Americans, more cheering. They had 16 vessels, of which 3 surpassed anything afloat. These were 44-gun frigates, the Constitution, the United States, and the President. They fired a heavier broadside than British frigates. They were heavily timbered, but their clean lines underwater enabled them to outsail any ship upon the seas. Their crews were volunteers, and their officers highly trained. A London journalist called them a few fur-built frigates manned by a handful of bastards and outlaws. This phrase was adopted with glee by the Americans, who gloried in disproving the insult. The British fleet on the transatlantic station consisted of 97 sail, including 11 ships of the line and 34 frigates. Their naval tradition was long and glorious, and, with their memories of Trafalgar and the Nile, the English captains were confident they could sink any American. But when one English ship after another found its guns outranged and was battered to pieces, the reputation of the fur-built frigates was startlingly made. The American public, smarting at the disasters in Canada, gained new heart from these victories. Their frigates, within a year, had won more successes over the British than the French and Spaniards in 2 decades of warfare. But retribution was at hand. On June 1, 1813, the American frigate Chesapeake, under Captain Lawrence, sailed from Boston Harbour with a green and mutinous crew to accept a challenge from Captain Broke of HMS Shannon. After a 15-minute flight, the Chesapeake surrendered. Other American losses followed, and command of the ocean passed into British hands. American privateers, however, continued to harry British shipping throughout the rest of the war. These naval episodes had no effect on the general course of the war, and if the British government had abandoned impressment, a new campaign might have been avoided in 1813. But they did not do so, and the Americans set about revising their strategy. The war was continuing officially upon the single issue of impressment, for the conquest of Canada was never announced as a war aim by the United States. Nevertheless, Canada was their main objective. By land, the Americans made a number of raids into the province of Upper Canada, now named Ontario. Towns and villages were sacked and burnt, including the little capital which has since become the great city of Toronto. The war was becoming fiercer. During the winter of 1812 to 1813, the Americans had also established a base at Fort Presqu'île on Lake Erie, and stores were laboriously hauled over the mountains to furnish the American commander, Captain Oliver H. Perry, with a flotilla for freshwater fighting. In the autumn, Perry's little armada sailed to victory. A strange amphibious battle was fought in September 1813. Negroes, frontier scouts, and militiamen, aboard craft hastily built of new green wood, fought to the end upon the still waters of the lake. The American ships were heavier, and the British were defeated with heavy loss. "We have met the enemy," Perry reported laconically, "and they are ours." Harrison, American victor at Tippecanoe, could now advance into Ontario. In October, at the Battle of the Thames, he destroyed a British army which had beaten him earlier in the year, together with its Indian allies. The Indian Confederacy was broken, and Tecumseh was killed. Thus the United States were established on the southern shores of the Great Lakes, and the Indians could no longer outflank their frontier. But the invasion of Upper Canada on land had been a failure, and the year ended with the Canadians in possession of Fort Niagara. Hitherto, the British in Canada had lacked the means for offensive action. Troops and ships in Europe were locked in the deadly struggle against Napoleon. Moreover, the British government was anxious not to irritate the New England states by threatening them from the north. Even the blockade was not extended to cover Massachusetts until 1814, and indeed the British forces were almost entirely fed from the New England ports. But by the spring of 1814, a decision had been reached in Europe. Napoleon abdicated in April, and the British could at last send adequate reinforcements. They purposed to strike from Niagara, from Montreal by way of Lake Champlain, and in the south at New Orleans, with simultaneous naval raids on the American coast. The campaign opened before Wellington's veterans could arrive from the peninsula. The advance from Niagara was checked by a savage, drawn battle at Lundy's Lane, near the falls. But by the end of August, 11,000 troops from Europe had been concentrated near Montreal to advance by Burgoyne's old route down the Hudson Valley. In September, under Sir George Prevost, they moved on Plattsburgh and prepared to dispute the command of Lake Champlain. They were faced by a mere 1,500 American regulars, supported by a few thousand militia. All depended on the engagement of the British and American flotillas. As at Lake Erie, the Americans built better ships for freshwater fighting, and they gained the victory. This crippled the British advance and was the most decisive engagement of the war. Prevost and his forces retired into Canada. At sea, in spite of their reverses of the previous years, the British were supreme. More ships arrived from European waters. The American coast was defenceless. In August, the British General Ross landed in Chesapeake Bay at the head of 4,000 men. The American militia, 7,000 strong but raw and untrained, retreated rapidly, and on the 24th, British troops entered the federal capital of Washington. President Madison took refuge in Virginia. So hasty was the American withdrawal that English officers sat down to a meal cooked for him and his family in the White House. The White House and the Capitol were then burnt in reprisal for the conduct of American militiamen in Canada. Washington's home on the Potomac was spared and strictly guarded by the British. The campaign ended in an attempt to land at Baltimore, but here the militia were ready. General Ross was killed, and a retreat to the ships followed. In December, the last and most irresponsible British onslaught, the expedition to New Orleans, reached its base. But here, in the frontier lands of the Southwest, a military leader of high quality had appeared in the person of Andrew Jackson. As an early settler in Tennessee, he had won a reputation in warfare against the Indians. When the British now tried to subsidize and organize them, Jackson pursued them into Spanish West Florida and occupied its capital, Pensacola. Meanwhile, 8,000 British troops had landed at New Orleans under Sir Edward Pakenham, who'd commanded a division at Salamanca. The swamps and inlets in the mouth of the Mississippi made an amphibious operation extremely dangerous. All men and stores had to be transported 70 miles in rowboats from the fleet. Jackson hastened back from Florida and entrenched himself on the left bank of the river. His forces were much inferior in numbers, but composed of highly skilled marksmen. On the morning of January the 8th, 1815, Pakenham led a frontal assault against the American earthworks, one of the most unintelligent manoeuvres in the history of British warfare. Here he was slain, and 2,000 of his troops were killed or wounded. The only surviving general officer withdrew the army to its transports. The Americans lost 70 men, 13 of them killed. The battle had lasted precisely half an hour. Peace between England and America had meanwhile been signed on Christmas Eve, 1814. But the Battle of New Orleans is an important event in American history. It made the career of a future president, Jackson. It led to the belief that the Americans had decisively won the war. And it created an evil legend that the struggle had been a second war of independence against British tyranny. On the American domestic scene, events had been moving fast. New England, dependent upon shipping and commerce, was suffering heavily and her leaders were embarrassed. They had supported the Federalist Party, now in disarray. They resented the predominance of the Western states and territories, which had pushed them into war, and they began to contemplate leaving the Union. In the summer of 1814, Massachusetts had been thrown upon her own resources. British troops were in Maine. The harbours were blockaded by British ships. The burden of taxation fell largely upon the New England states, yet the federal government seemed incapable of providing even a local defence. In October, a convention of delegates from Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut was summoned to meet. They assembled at Hartford in December. They wanted a separate peace with Great Britain and no further connection with the fast-growing West. They believed that the British expedition to New Orleans would succeed, and that the West, cut off from the sea, would probably leave the Union on its own initiative. The President was alarmed, and the War Party feared the worst. Fortunately for the United States, the moderate New England politicians gained the upper hand at Hartford, and the convention only drew up a severe arraignment of Madison's administration. For the time being, secession was killed. To attempt, they declared, upon every abuse of power to change the Constitution, would be to perpetuate the evils of revolution. Andrew Jackson's victory at New Orleans and the success of the peace negotiations produced an outcry against the disloyalty of New England and attached a permanent stigma to the Federalist Party. Yet the doctrine of state rights, to which the Hartford delegates held, was to remain a vivid force in American politics. The war had also done much to diversify New England's economy. To her shipping and commercial interests were added great and rewarding developments in manufacture and industry. Peace negotiations had been tried throughout the war, but it was not until January 1814 that the British had agreed to treat. The American commissioners, among them Henry Clay, reached Ghent in June. At first, the British refused to discuss either neutral rights or impressment, and they still hoped for an Indian buffer state in the northwest. It was Wellington's common sense which changed the atmosphere. The previous November, he'd been asked to take command in America, but he'd studied reports of the Battle of Plattsburgh and realized that victory depended on naval superiority upon the lakes. He saw no way of gaining it. He held, moreover, that it was not in Britain's interest to demand territory from America on the Canadian border. Both sides therefore agreed upon the status quo for the long boundary in the north. Other points were left undetermined. Naval forces on the Great Lakes were regulated by a commission in 1817, and the disputed boundary of Maine was similarly settled later. By the time the British Navy went to war again, impressment had been abandoned. Thus ended a futile and unnecessary conflict. Anti-American feeling in Great Britain ran high for several years, but the United States were never again refused proper treatment as an independent power. The British Army and Navy had learned to respect their former colonials. When news of peace reached the British Army in the New World, one of the soldiers wrote, "We are all happy enough, for we peninsular soldiers saw that neither fame nor any other military distinction could be acquired by this type of milito-nautico-guerrilla-plundering warfare." The results of the peace were solid and enduring. The war was a turning point in the history of Canada. Canadians took pride in the part they'd played in defending their country, and their growing national sentiment was strengthened. Many disagreements were still to shake Anglo-American relations. 30 years later, in the dispute over the possession of Oregon, vast territories were involved, and there was a threat of war. But henceforward, the world was to see a 3,000-mile international frontier between Canada and the United States, undefended by men or guns. On the oceans, the British Navy ruled supreme for a century to come. And behind this shield, the United States were free to fulfill their continental destiny. Chapter 10. Elba and Waterloo. In the new year of 1815, peace reigned in Europe and in America. In Paris, a stout, elderly, easygoing Bourbon sat on the throne of France, oblivious of the mistakes made by his relations, advisers, and followers. His royalist supporters, more royal than their king, were trying the patience of his newfound subjects. The French people, still dreaming of imperial glories, were ripe for another adventure. At Vienna, the powers of Europe had solved one of their most vexatious problems. They had decided how to apportion the peoples of Saxony and Poland among the hungry victors, Prussia and Russia. But they were still by no means in accord on many details of the map of Europe which they had met to redraw. After the exertions of 20 years of warfare, they felt they'd earned leisure enough to indulge in haggling, bargains, and festivity. A sharp and sudden shock was needed to recall them to their unity of purpose. It came from a familiar quarter. Napoleon had for 9 months been sovereign of Elba. The former master of the continent now looked out upon a shrunken island domain. He kept about him the apparatus of imperial dignity. He applied to the iron mines and tunny fisheries of his little kingdom the same probing energy that had once set great armies in motion. He still possessed an army. It included 400 members of his old guard, a few displaced Polish soldiers, and a local militia. He also had a navy, for which he devised a special Elban ensign. His fleet consisted of a single brig and some cutters. To these puny armaments and to the exiguous Elban budget he devoted his attention. He would henceforth give himself up, he told the people of Elba, to the task of ensuring their happiness. For their civic dignitaries he invented an impressive uniform. At Porto Ferrajo, his capital, he furnished a palace in the grand manner. He played cards with his mother, and cheated according to his recognized custom. He entertained his favorite sister and his faithful Polish mistress. Only his wife, the Empress Marie Louise, and their son were missing. The Austrian government took care to keep them both in Vienna. The Empress showed no sign of wishing to break her parole. Family Habsburg loyalty meant more to her than her husband. A stream of curious foreign visitors came to see the fallen emperor, many from Britain. One of them reported, perhaps not without prejudice, that he looked more like a crafty priest than a great commander. The resident Allied commissioner on Elba, Sir Neil Campbell, knew better. As the months went by, close observers became sure that Napoleon was biding his time. He was keeping a watch on events in France and Italy. Through spies, he was in touch with many currents of opinion. He perceived that the restored Bourbons could not command the loyalty of the French. Besides, they'd failed to pay him the annual pension stipulated in the Treaty of Peace. This act of pettiness persuaded Napoleon that he was absolved from honouring the treaty's terms. In February 1815, he saw, or thought he saw, that the Congress of Vienna was breaking up. The Allies were at odds, and France, discontented, beckoned to him. Campbell, the shrewd Scottish watchdog, was absent in Italy. Of all this conjunction of circumstances, Napoleon took lightning advantage. On Sunday night, the 26th of February, he slipped out of harbour in his brig, attended by a small train of lesser vessels. At the head of 1,000 men, he set sail for France. On March the 1st, he landed near Antibes. The local band, welcoming him, played the French equivalent of Home Sweet Home. The drama of the 100 days had begun, and a bloodless march to Paris ensued. Royalist armies sent to stop the intruder melted away or went over to him. Marshal Ney, the bravest of the brave, who'd taken service under the Bourbons, boasted that he would bring his former master back to Paris in an iron cage. He found he could not resist the Emperor's call. He joined Napoleon. Other marshals who turned their coats now turned them again. Within 18 days of his landing, Napoleon was installed in the capital. The Bourbons ran for cover and found it at Ghent. Meanwhile, the Emperor proclaimed his peaceful intentions and at once started shaping his army. He bid for support by promising liberal institutions to the French people. In fact, he dreamed of restoring all the old forms of empire as soon as he had behind him the consolidation of military victory. But the mood of France had changed since the high noon of Austerlitz, Jena, and Wagram. There was enthusiasm, but no longer at the topmost fighting pitch. The army and its leaders were not what they had been. The frightful losses of the Russian campaign and of Leipzig could not be made good. Since 1805, 148 French generals had fallen in battle. Of those that remained, only half were now loyal to Napoleon. Marshals like Marmont and Victor had fled to Belgium. Victor in Brussels had taken refuge in the Wellington Hotel. It was named after the Duke who'd beaten him at Talavera. Marshal Berthier, the Emperor's indispensable chief of staff, failed to rally to him, and Napoleon had to rely, as he afterwards complained, on that idiot Soult. He showed all his usual energy. He abounded in self-confidence. But the flashing military judgment of earlier years was dimmed. The gastric ulcer from which he had long suffered caused him intermittent pain. Yet the Emperor remained a formidable figure and a challenge to Europe. The powers at Vienna acted with unaccustomed speed and unanimity. They declared Napoleon an outlaw. He was pronounced a disturber of world peace who had rendered himself liable to public indictment. The powers, too, set about marshalling their forces. The British government, which had led the country and the world against the Corsican, realized that they would have to bear the brunt of a whirlwind campaign. It would take time for Russia and Austria to muster their strength. Prussia was the only main ally then in readiness. There was no time to lose. Wellington recommended the immediate transport of an army to the Netherlands to form bases for a march on Paris and prepare for a clash upon the frontiers. Within a month of the escape from Elba, Wellington took up his command at Brussels. The state of his army did not please the Duke. Many of his best troops from the peninsula had gone to America, including his chief of staff, Sir George Murray. With great difficulty, the British government had collected 6 regiments of cavalry and 25 battalions of infantry, consisting partly of peninsula veterans and partly of untrained boys. The biggest deficiency was in artillery. On the conclusion of the Peace of Paris in 1814, the British cabinet had ordered the wholesale discharge of gunners and drivers, and the shortage was now serious. But there were, as in all European wars, the Continental Allies and Auxiliaries. The King of Great Britain was still King of Hanover. Hanoverian troops on their way home through the Netherlands were halted and joined the new army. Wellington, at a loss for numbers, tried to persuade the Portuguese to send a few battalions. He taught them the arts of war, and he was proud of his fighting cocks, as he called them. But his efforts were in vain. The Dutch and Belgian troops put under his command by the King of the Netherlands looked unreliable. Their countries had for 20 years been occupied by the French, and the Belgians, at least, had not taken unkindly to French rule. The sympathies of their rank and file would probably waver towards Napoleon. There were contingents also from Nassau and other German provinces. As the summer drew near, Wellington assembled a mixed force of 83,000 men, of whom about a third were British. He bluntly cursed, as was his habit, the quality of his untried troops, while bending all his endeavours to train and transform them. The main support for his new adventure must be Marshal Blücher. The Prussians had a force of 113,000 men, but nearly half of them were untrained militia. They lay in eastern Belgium. Wellington, with his staff, planned a large-scale advance into France. He meant to take the offensive. He did not propose tamely to await a Napoleonic onslaught. In his calm, considering way, he worked it all out. Based upon Brussels, he took up a line between Maubeuge and Beaumont, with the Prussians on his left holding the position between Philippeville and Givet. As it happened, the Emperor seized his usual initiative. Napoleon could not afford to waste a day, nor did he do so. His 2 main enemies stood on his northeastern frontier within a few days' march of his capital. He must strike immediately at his gathering foes. The moral value of victory would be overwhelming, and the prestige of the British government would be shaken. His admirers in London, the Pacific Whigs, might replace the Tories and proffer a negotiated peace. Louis XVIII would be driven into permanent exile, and the Belgian Netherlands restored to French rule. This achieved, he could face with equanimity the menaces of Austria and Russia. Such were his hopes while he applied his intense power of will to rousing the French nation. Assembling a sufficient army threw a heavy strain upon exhausted France. 5 corps of about 125,000 men were organized on the frontier fortress line. The protection afforded by these fortresses, behind which he could build up at leisure, gave Napoleon the impetus in the opening phases of the campaign. Wellington was obliged to canton his troops upon a possible defence line of 40 miles, and to guard against a French stroke at the point of junction between the British and Prussian armies. During the early days of June, tension was heightening. It was plain, or at least predictable, that Napoleon would attempt to rout Wellington's and Blücher's armies separately and piecemeal. But where would he land his first blow? Wellington waited patiently in Brussels for a sign of the Emperor's intention. He and his great opponent were to cross swords for the first time. They were both in their 46th year. Quietly, on June the 15th, Napoleon crossed the Sambre at Charleroi and Marchiennes, driving the Prussian forward troops before him to within 25 miles of Brussels. He had struck at the hinge of the Allied armies. The capture of Brussels would be a great forward stride. Possession of a capital city was always a lure for him and a source of strength. Liaison between the British and Prussians was mysteriously defective, and hours passed before the news reached Wellington. It seemed as though there was no detailed plan of cooperation between the Allied commanders. Military intelligence, as so often at the nape of events, was confusing and contradictory. There were no British troops on the Waterloo-Charleroi road, which was held thinly by a Dutch-Belgian division. On the night of the 15th, while the French armies massed to destroy the Prussians, the Duchess of Richmond gave a ball in Brussels in honour of the Allied officers. Wellington graced the occasion with his presence. He knew the value of preserving a bold, unruffled face. Amid the dancing, he reflected on the belated news which had reached him. At all costs, contact must be maintained with the Prussians, and the French advance upon Brussels held. Wellington resolved to concentrate on the strategic point of Quatre Bras. In the early hours of the morning of the 16th, Picton's brigade rumbled down the Brussels road to join the Dutch troops already covering this dangerous ground lying open between the British and Prussian array. For the French, everything depended upon beating the Prussians before forcing Wellington northwestwards to the coast. Napoleon had in mind the vision of a shattered British army grimly awaiting transports for home in the Flemish ports. At Coruña and Walcheren, such things had happened before. Leaving Ney with the French left, the Emperor swung with 63,000 men and 92 guns to meet the main Prussian army centred in Ligny. But the tardiness and sureness of Wellington's movements deceived him. Realising that so far only a small force held the position at Quatre Bras, he ordered Ney to attack and then meet him that evening in Brussels. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon of the 16th, the French went into action on a 2-mile front. Wellington himself arrived to take command with a force of 7,000 men and 16 guns. The brunt of the battle fell upon Picton's leading brigade. After having marched for 12 hours from Brussels, these peninsular veterans steadily pressed on. In vain the French cavalry swirled round them, while the allied Dutch and Belgian infantry were edged from the field. There was little tactical manoeuvre in the fierce struggle which swayed backwards and forwards on that June afternoon at the crossroads on the way to Brussels. It was a head-on collision in which generalship played no part, though leadership did. Wellington was always at his coolest in the hottest of moments. In this battle of private soldiers, the firepower of the British infantry prevailed. Out of 30,000 men engaged by nightfall on their side, the Allies lost 4,600, the French somewhat less. But Ney had not gained his objective. Brussels was not in his grasp. On the French side, the staff work had hardly been creditable. D'Erlon, under Napoleon's orders, had marched aimlessly about, at one time in the direction of Ligny, and at another towards Quatre Bras. Napoleon had gained the advantage at the opening of the campaign, but he had not intended that both wings of his army should be in action at once. He seems to have departed from his original plan. At Ligny, however, he won a striking success. Marshal Blücher was outgeneraled, his army split in two, battered by the magnificent French artillery, and driven back on Wavre. Again, liaison between the Allied armies broke down. Wellington had no immediate information of the outcome at Ligny, nor of the subsequent movements of the Prussians. He'd held the French left at Quatre Bras, but their victory to the east enabled them to concentrate their strength against him and the Brussels road. Wellington's main body had gathered around the village of Quatre Bras by the time he learnt of the Prussian defeat. Napoleon decided, in the small hours of the 17th, to send Marshal Grouchy with 33,000 men to pursue the Prussians, while he flung his main weight against Wellington. The crisis of the campaign was at hand. There seems no doubt that in the opening days Wellington had been surprised. As he confessed at the time, Napoleon's movements had humbugged him. Years later, when he read French accounts of Quatre Bras, he declared with his habitual frankness, "Damn them, I beat them, and if I was surprised, if I did place myself in so foolish a position, they were the greater fools for not knowing how to take advantage of my faults." Immediately after the battle, his methodical mind was in full command of the situation. His plan was to fall back upon a prepared position at Mont-Saint-Jean, which British engineers had examined before the campaign of the previous year. There he would accept battle, and all he asked from the Prussians was the support of one corps. Wellington himself had inspected this Belgian countryside in the autumn of 1814. He'd noted the advantages of the ridge at Waterloo. So had the great Duke of Marlborough a century earlier, when his Dutch allies had prevented him from engaging Marshal Villeroy there. His unfought battle was now to unroll. Throughout the night of the 16th and 17th, a carefully screened retreat began, and by morning the Waterloo position, a line of defence such as Wellington had already tested in the peninsula, was occupied. Upon the French must be forced the onus of a frontal attack. Wellington knew that time was playing against his adversary. Swift results must be achieved by Napoleon if he was to establish himself again in France. A line of fortified farms and rolling slopes made up the Allied front, held by 63,000 men and 156 guns. The French troops failed to harass the retreat. Their staff work had again gone awry. Napoleon was unaware of what had happened at Quatre Bras, and there was an imminent danger that the Prussians would fall back and unite with Wellington. That was indeed their intention. Blücher and his chief of staff, Gneisenau, who was the brain of the Prussian army, were retiring northwest from Ligny in the direction of Brussels. Grouchy, misinformed or misjudging, thought they were moving northeast towards Liège. He remained out of touch and ineffective. Grouchy's was a costly mistake for the French. Meanwhile, Napoleon, furious to hear of Wellington's skilful withdrawal, pounded in his carriage down the Brussels road with his advance guard in a desperate attempt to entrap the British rear. The mercy of a violent storm slowed up progress. The English cavalry galloped for safety through the thunder and torrential rain. An angry scene took place upon the meeting of Napoleon and Ney, who was greeted with the words from the Emperor, "You have ruined France." As Napoleon reached the ridge of Waterloo and saw the British already in their positions, he realized how complete had been their escape. Late in the morning of the 18th of June, the French attacked both flanks of the Allied position, of which the key points were the fortified château of Hougoumont on the right and the farm of La Haye Sainte in the middle. Napoleon promised his staff they would sleep that night in Brussels. And to Soult, who raised some demur, he said, "You think Wellington a great general because he beat you? I tell you, this will be a picnic." Then 70,000 French troops and 224 guns were concentrated for the decisive assault. Fierce cannonades were launched upon the Allied posts. The battle swayed backwards and forwards upon the grass slopes, and intense fighting centred in the farm of La Haye Sainte, which eventually fell to the French. At Hougoumont, which held out all day, the fighting was heavier still. In the early afternoon, one of the most terrific artillery barrages of the time was launched upon Wellington's infantry as preparation for the major cavalry advance of 15,000 troopers under Ney. Under the hail of the French guns, Wellington moved his infantry farther back over the ridge of Waterloo to give them a little more shelter. On seeing this, Ney launched his squadrons in a series of attacks. Everything now depended upon the British muskets and bayonets. Anxiously, Wellington looked eastwards for a sign of the Prussians. They were on their way, for Blücher was keeping faith. But the French cuirassiers were upon the Duke. They never reached the infantry squares. As one eyewitness wrote, "As to the so-called charges, I do not think that on a single occasion actual collision occurred. I many times saw the cuirassiers come on with boldness to within some 20 or 30 yards of a square, when, seeing the steady firmness of our men, they invariably edged away and retired. Sometimes they would halt and gaze at the triple row of bayonets, when 2 or 3 brave officers would advance and strive to urge the attack, raising their helmets aloft on their sabres. But all in vain, as no efforts could make the men close with the terrible bayonets and meet certain destruction." No visible decision was achieved. Napoleon, looking through his glasses at the awful melee, exclaimed, "Will the English never show their backs?" "I fear," replied Soult, "they will be cut to pieces first." Wellington, too, had much to disturb him. Although the Prussians had been distantly sighted upon the roads in the early afternoon, they were slow in making their presence felt upon the French right. But by 6 o'clock in the evening, Ney's onslaughts had failed, and the Prussians were beating relentlessly upon the wing. They drew off 14,000 men from the forces assailing Wellington. The French made a final effort, and desperate fighting with no quarter raged again around the farms. The Imperial Guard itself, with Ney at its head, rolled up the hill, but again the fury of British infantry fire held them. The long-awaited moment to counterattack had come. Wellington had been in the forefront of danger all day. On his chestnut, Copenhagen, he'd galloped everywhere, issuing brusque orders, gruffly encouraging his men. Now he rode along his much-battered line and ordered the advance. "Go on! Go on!" he shouted. "They will not stand!" His cavalry swept from the ridge and sabred the French army into a disorganized mass of stragglers. Ney, beside himself with rage, a broken sword in his hand, staggered shouting in vain from one band to another. It was too late. Wellington handed over the pursuit to the Prussians. In agony of soul, Napoleon followed the road back to Paris. Late that night, Blücher and Wellington met and embraced. "Mein lieber Kamerad," said the old German field marshal, who knew not a word of English. "Quelle affaire!" Which was about all the French he could command. This brief greeting was greatly to Wellington's laconic taste. It was a story he delighted to repeat in later years when he was Lord Warden of the Cinque Ports, recalling his memories at Walmer. The Duke rode back to Brussels. The day had been almost too much, even for a man of iron. The whole weight of responsibility had fallen on him. Only the power and example of his own personality had kept his motley force together. The strain had been barely tolerable. "By God," as he justly said, "I don't think it would have been done if I had not been there." As he took tea and toast and had the casualty lists read to him, he broke down and wept. Letters of congratulation poured in to the Duke in the days that followed. Prince Metternich, the Austrian Chancellor, conveyed his appreciation of what he cautiously called the brilliant opening of the campaign. In fact, it was all over. Blücher and his Prussians marched steadily and uneventfully upon Paris. Napoleon had reached his capital 3 days after the battle. He had a momentary surge of hope. He would fight again in France, a campaign like that of 1814. But no one shared his optimism. The grand officials of the empire, who owed him their positions and fortunes, had had enough. On June the 22nd, he abdicated and retired to Malmaison. The treacherous Fouché headed a provisional government and set about treating with the Allies and with Louis the 18th. There was nothing else to be done. On July the 6th, Blücher and Wellington entered the capital. One of the Duke's first tasks was to restrain the Prussians from resentful vengeance. Their army, in 1806, had been thrashed by the French, their country mutilated, and their garrison towns occupied. They nourished a bitterness which the Duke did not share. When Blücher proposed to blow up the bridge of Jena over the Seine, named after the celebrated Prussian defeat, Wellington posted British sentries to prevent him. 2 days after the Allies' arrival, Louis the 18th appeared. His second restoration was largely of Wellington's making. Most Frenchmen, and many of the Allies, would have preferred a monarchy under the Duke of Orléans, a regency for Napoleon's young son, or a constitutional republic. Wellington had no high regard for the Bourbons, but he was convinced that France under their shaky rule would no longer have the power to disturb the peace of Europe. Louis the 18th was no grand monarch and could never aspire to become one. Wellington, like many great soldiers when victory is complete, looked forward to an age of tranquillity. Laurels and bays had been won. It was time to cultivate the olive. Napoleon left Malmaison at the end of June. He made for Rochefort on the Biscay coast, narrowly evading capture on the way by Blücher's Prussians. Had they taken him, they would have shot him. He had thoughts of sailing for America, and he ordered a set of travel books about the transatlantic continent. Perhaps a new empire might be forged in Mexico, Peru, or Brazil. The alternative was to throw himself upon the mercy of his most inveterate foe. This is what happened. Captain Maitland in the Bellerophon was cruising off Rochefort with orders to prevent any French ships from putting to sea. With him, Napoleon entered into negotiation. Maitland offered him asylum on his ship. He could not forecast what the British government would decide to do with his eminent hostage, nor did he make any promise. Napoleon hoped he might be kept in pleasant captivity in some English country house or Scottish castle. Marshal Tallard and other French generals a century earlier had enjoyed their forced residence in England. The ex-emperor wrote a flattering letter to the Prince Regent, whom he addressed as "the strongest, the stubbornest, the most generous of my foes." When the prince read this missive, it must have helped to convince him that he, and not his generals or his ministers, had really won the war. On this matter, he did not need much convincing. The Bellerophon anchored in Torbay, and curious Devonshire crowds gazed upon the Corsican ogre, while Lord Liverpool and the cabinet deliberated in London. Newspapers clamoured that Napoleon should be put on trial. The government, acting for the Allies, decided on exile in St. Helena, an island about the same size as Jersey, but very mountainous and far away. Escape from it was impossible. On July the 26th, the Emperor sailed to his sunset in the South Atlantic. He never permitted himself to understand what had happened at Waterloo. The event was everybody's fault but his own. 6 years of life in exile lay before him. He spent them with his small faithful retinue, creating the Napoleonic legend of invincibility, which was to have so powerful an effect on the France of the future. The Congress of Vienna had completed its work in June. It remained for the emissaries of the powers to assemble in Paris and compose a new peace with France. The task took 3 months. The Prussians pressed for harsh terms. Castlereagh, representing Britain, saw that mildness would create the least grievance and guard best against a renewal of war. In this he had the hearty support of Wellington, who now exerted a unique authority throughout Europe. The second Treaty of Paris, concluded in November, was somewhat stiffer than that of 1814. Together with the loss of certain small territories, France was to pay an indemnity of 700 million francs, and to submit to an Allied army of occupation for 3 years. Yet no intolerable humiliations were involved. In the moderation of the settlement with France, the treaty had its greatest success. Wellington took command of the occupying army. For the next 3 years, he was practically a great European power in himself. Castlereagh, with his sombre cast of mind, thought the treaty would be justified if it kept the peace for 7 years. He'd built better than he knew. Peace reigned for 40 years between the great powers, and the main framework of the settlements at Vienna and Paris endured until the 20th century. The treaties drawn up in 1815 were the last great European settlements until 1919 to 1920. Herbert Fisher, the liberal historian and cabinet minister, has thus compared the two settlements. Talleyrand's formula of legitimacy summed up the spirit of the settlement. It was legitimacy which restored the Bourbons to France, saved Saxony for the Wettins, and confirmed the power of the House of Sardinia. No respect was paid to nationality or to the wishes of the populations concerned. In all essentials, therefore, the statesman who drew up the settlement at Vienna was sharply opposed in aims and principles to the artifices of the Europe in which we now live. The peace treaties of 1920 constituted a democratic settlement made possible only by the downfall of those very monarchies to which the Congress of Vienna had entrusted the policing of Europe. The settlement of 1920, created new republics, redistributed frontiers, accepted the dissolution of the old Austrian Empire, and built up a Europe on that principle of self-determination which had been preached by the French revolutionaries, but was afterwards long lost to view. To the Congress of Vienna, the principles of President Wilson would have been anathema. Guided by Metternich, Talleyrand, and Castlereagh, it held that the well-being of Europe was to be secured not by compliance with the assumed wishes of the peoples concerned, but only by punctual obedience to legitimate authority. Castlereagh might dismiss the Holy Alliance which was now formed between the three autocratic powers, Russia, Prussia, and Austria, as a piece of sublime mysticism and nonsense. It was indeed a product of the Tsar Alexander's soaring, cloudy brain. Yet for the sake of stability, Castlereagh was prepared to see Romanovs, Hohenzollerns, and Habsburgs re-establish their reactionary authority throughout the greater part of Central and Eastern Europe, in defiance of all popular movements for nationality and freedom. Such was the price that Europe paid for the overthrow of Napoleon. Even the principle of legitimacy was discarded when it clashed with the interests of one of the great powers. Poland, still independent in 1792, was no longer accounted legitimate in 1814. Part of the Kingdom of Saxony and the Prince